Okay, today's talk is entitled Heretics Teaching on Suffering, Elisha Ben Avuya's Legacy. Before I start, just a note about the term heretic. Heretic is probably a term that's more appropriate to the Christian and Islamic traditions. Probably, to my mind and to many people's minds, not appropriate in the Jewish tradition for numerous reasons. But to use a very inappropriate cliche for today, when in Rome, you use the word, I'll use the common term. So that's one. Two is that the heretic, there seems to be a kind of loosening of the term heretic in today's world, where we use it for anybody, from somebody who thinks that evolution is true, that is heretical, to all kinds of minor things that have been accepted by various people in the tradition. We've kind of cheapened the term. Heretic is somebody who comes from within, deeply within the tradition, has thought about it, and has raised, or issues have been raised in his mind, very profound issues that cause him ultimately to seriously question or reject or find that he can no longer live within the tradition he was raised in. The term heretic is something that one must earn. Not every schnook deserves the term heretic. So that's just a note before I start. So what I'd like to do is start with a Mishnah, which is in the name of our central character, Elisha ben Avuya. This is a Mishnah, many of you may know it, from Pirkei Avot, which has the following saying in his name. As you know, Pirkei Avot follows a chain of transmission, a kind of chain of line of received traditions from Moses, establishing a solid link between Sinai and Chazal, Sinai and the classical rabbis. And one of those links is Elisha ben Avuya. And he has something to say. And this is what he says. Elisha ben Avuya Omer, Halomed Yeled Lama Hudomeh, when somebody learns as a youth, as a young person, to what is he compared to? Lidyo Ktuva Al Niyar Chadash, to ink that has been written on brand new paper. Let's call it paper. Valomeid Zakan, and somebody who learns when he's older, Lamahu Domeh, Lidiok Tuva Al Niyar Mahuk, to ink that is written on rubbed out paper. Now, this is very interesting. That is, it is talking about a very current phenomena in its day, commonly known now as a palimpsest. That is, we have, and this is probably one of the most common common sources for our knowledge of classical antiquity. That is, paper is hard to come by. This is not a throwaway society in those days. You don't just throw away paper, you recycle it. And often the method of recycling is you write on something and then you write over it. So the Mishnah here, Elisha ben Avuya, is actually talking about something very real that was done. And when one learns in his older age, it's compared to ink being written on this kind of parchment or this kind of paper, where something else has been written on it already. In fact, in my experience, I'm involved in this Geniza project, and now we're starting to see that many of these documents that were recovered in the shul in Egypt are very valuable for what is written actually underneath. And now that research has begun as well with modern technology, infrared technology, and we're discovering some spectacular specimens that way. But going back to this Mishnah, virtually all the Mephorshim, virtually I think all the Mephorshim that I could find, read this, as I think maybe all of us did, that is, it's the virtue of learning when you're young, and possibly the vice of learning when you're old, or the advantages of learning when you're young, and the disadvantages of learning when you're old. And what's that? I have a few here. You have the commentary of the Rambam on the Mishnah, his Perush HaMishnayot. Shehalimud biyaldut yitkayem. How does he explain it? That youthful learning is vital. It's invigorated with youth. And it remains. It stands the test of time. And forgetfulness doesn't come in to operation. That is, it's easy to remember. Forgetfulness doesn't come around. Va'inyan b'limud azikna, however, when one learns when he's old, behefech. V'zeh mevuar v'yadua. This is clear and well known. That's one perush. Ovadya Midbar Tanura, the classic commentary on the Mishnah, says al niyar chadash, on brand new paper, shehu mitkayem, because the brand new paper doesn't fall apart, doesn't get frayed, it stands, again, the test of time. Kach girsat hayaldut eina mishtachacha. So, the learning of your youth is not forgotten. And there are others as well, but all of them read this in some form or another as the advantages of learning in your youth and the disadvantages of learning at an elderly age. Fair enough. Probably, if they all say it, that's probably the pshat of the Mishnah. However, I have a couple of questions, which I think are valid questions, and that is two main ones. One is Elisha ben Avuya, and I'll go on to explain who he is, but as a kind of short introduction, Elisha ben Avuya is probably the arch-rabbinic heretic in the classical rabbinic literature. So bad that his name has been effaced, and he was given another sobriquet, another name, the Other. When he's referred to, he's referred to as the Other, Acher. My first question on this is, here you have actually a teaching, a very solid teaching, a teaching among a very respectable tradition, among many others, in his name. So Elisha ben Avuya's name has been memorialized, despite Chazal's other efforts to efface his name. So my first question is, why memorialize his name here? Why have it in Pirkei Avot, which is a very, very prominent text, learned by many people, even those who don't often look at the classical rabbinic texts? Second, what even makes the question, I think, more difficult, is that if this is a heretic, and if his name should be effaced, his name appears in also Pirkei Avot, which has another purpose besides giving us various desiderata, various kind of nice sayings, nice adages, behavior to follow. But it also, the other primary importance of Avot is that it establishes, as I said, this chain of transmission, this unbreakable chain of transmission between Sinai and Chazal. And Elisha ben Avuya is one of those links in the chain. Why would you want the heretic to be one of those links in the chain? If it is a heretic and you find out what he stands for, I suppose the chain could be broken at that point. Second question, there's a couple of parts to my first question, but the second question is the content, not the author. The first was about the author. The second one was about the content of the saying. It seems to me a bit unseemly. Why would you want to extol the virtues of youth and denigrate older age, especially with learning? Why would you want to do that? This is inscribed in Pirkei Avot. It when I first read the Mishnah many, many years ago, it always kind of bugged me. It kind of bugged me, not just the name of the author of the statement, but the content of the statement. What is so great about this statement? Denigrating older people learning? In fact, I would think quite the opposite, right? In our tradition, we tend to respect older learning. respect the experience that comes with older learning? So those are the questions that occur to me that I will try to respond to in the rest of my talk. There is one other place in the entire Talmud. I may be corrected here, but I think I did a search, not that I know the entire Talmud off by heart, that where a teaching, and not there are stories about Elisha ben Avuya, but where a teaching, so in this case you have a teaching memorialized by Elisha ben Avuya, and in another case you actually have a halacha in his name. And that halacha, the only other place again where some teaching or some halacha is passed over to us in Elisha ben Avuya's name, may give us a hint as to what he's about and why we want to keep him. It seems to me that Chazal wants to distance him and keep him at the same time. They're struggling with him. So that's source 2, Tanu Rabbanan, Shmua Krova Noheget Shiva V'Shloshim. Sorry that I have all the sources in Hebrew, but it's just easier for me to do this, but let me translate. There is a debate about when someone hears news of a death in the family and he hears it late, what does he observe? What are the rituals he observes? So, the Rabbanan say, Shmua Krova, and they explain what a close rumor or message, what is that? Krova is within the 30 days, within the Shloshim, if you hear about the death. Rechoka, if you hear about it after the 30 days. Then Rabbi Akiva says, after the 30 days, you only keep one day. Right? You don't keep the Shiva and the Shloshim. Then they bring a tale, which is often the case, maybe to prove otherwise. It's a bit complex, the Gemara. Ma'aseh, there is something happened. Umeit Aviv shel Rabbi Tzadok beginzak. So this rabbi's father died. Vahidu'u l'acher shalosh shalim. After 3 years, he got the message that his father died, which may tell us also about the times that we're living in here, which will be important. Important especially in relation to Tisha B'Av. Uba b'sha'al et Elisha ben Avuya v'skenim sha'imo. And they came to ask Elisha ben Avuya and his disciples, his elders that are with him, v'amru nahog shiva v'shloshim. Conduct both in opposition to Rabbi Akiva, conduct the ritual morning observances of both the shiva and the shloshim, both the 7 days and the 30 days. This is the only other, again, teaching that we have in his name that he's left over to us. The teaching is about death. And that started the wheels rolling. And to look at the other Gemaras that deal with Elisha ben Avuya, again, for a group, Chazal, that claim to want to efface somebody from their history, there is an awful lot about him in the Gemara, especially in the Talmud Chagiga. But this other teaching is about death. The first teaching, not about death, but about learning maybe close to death. The second teaching, about death. Death is something that Elisha ben Avuya and many of his age were very familiar with. And not only natural death. The fact that this message comes 3 years after the father died would indicate, though we don't really know, would indicate that something is amiss with deaths here. We're not living at home. Families may be torn apart. People may be missing. So now let me frame Elisha ben Avuya's background with the times. The times are, and we're talking about Rabbi Akiva, Elisha ben Avuya, the times are not exactly the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, but a time which I actually think is far worse. And that is Beitar and Asara Haruge Malchut, the martyrdom of the 10 great rabbis, the Hadrianic persecutions. I think far worse, and why do I say that? Is because when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, There was precedent for that. And there was also precedent for a rebuilding, a rebirth. So we know that when the Babylonians destroyed the Beit HaMikdash the first time, there was a very short, relatively speaking, galut. Another conqueror comes on the scene, shoves out the Babylonians, they come and go. We're around, allows us to go back and rebuild. So that hope, we know, is still there after the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. 69, 70. Here we're talking about close to the time of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which ends in catastrophe in 135. And the reason I say this time is worse is because at least after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, you have hope that history will repeat itself. Once Beitar happens, once the Bar Kokhba rebellion is crushed, there is no longer any hope in hell that we're going to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, we're going to regain our sovereignty. There is no hope at all. The last hope lay with Bar Kokhba. He was crushed, and that's it. And that's why I think that this time, the time that Elisha ben Avuya is living, and Rabbi Akiva, is a far worse time in terms of spirit, in terms of perceptions, in terms of optimism, in terms of what lies in the future. So now let's go to... there are many, many traditions explaining why Elisha ben Avuya becomes a heretic. Again, I use that term loosely. And the fact that we have so many traditions means to me, I suppose as a scholar, as a scholar of history, that we don't really know what Elisha ben Avuya did. However, there's a kernel that we can extract from all these stories. And then because he becomes this arch-heretic, all kinds of stuff is thrown on his head. He becomes kind of the whipping boy for whatever theology you find offensive. He's accused of all kinds of things, running from heresy to murder to collaboration with the Romans, all kinds of stuff. But let's look at some of the things that I think are the core teachings. And that is the following. If you look at 3a, and there are various versions of this, but this is one famous one. Acher Maihu, what is he about? Why did he become Acher? Ikeda Amri, some say, Ki hai gavna chaza. He saw the following. The Ikeda Amri, anyways, there are various traditions, but this is important. Lishna, the tongue of Chutzpit HaMeturgaman, the famous orator, was being dragged by a Davar Acher, which is taken to mean by most of the Meforshim, all of the Meforshim, as a pig. The tongue of this great orator is being dragged along the dirt by a pig. And Acher sees this, Elisha ben Avuya sees this, and he says, Peshi hipik mar Goliath, the mouth from which pearls came, is now being dragged in the dirt. Nafak chata. He went out and he sinned. That's one. Another version, and that's 3b, Al Yidei Shira'a L'Shono Shel Rav Yehuda Anachtum, another great sage, another great martyr, in the mouth of a dog. And it's a bit different, but interesting in its variants. Amar, Im Aloshon, if the tongue that involved itself in Torah all its days, a tongue that never knew or never involved itself in Torah, how much more so? And then he says, Imkein lo matan schar letzadikim v'lo tchiyat hameitim. If this is the case, there is no reward, there is no justice, there is no resurrection. He basically rejects any kind of future recompense for what one does in this life. If this is what happened to this great orator who devoted his life and his talents to Torah, then there is no way that what people have been telling me, maybe nobody has been telling him yet, is true. That there is resurrection, that there is retribution, that there is anything. It ends here. It ends here with this tongue being dragged in the dirt. Or another one, and I think you may start to see the thread that links all these different legends about where Acher went wrong. So here is in 3C, Ra'a Adam Echad. So what does he do? He sees somebody go to the top of a tree, take on Shabbat, which is a no-no, take the mother, and everybody knows that there is a law that you must shoo the mother away before taking the eggs. Take the mother, take the eggs without shooing away the mother, and comes down and goes along his merry way. Another man goes up to the top, does what he's supposed to do according to the mitzvah of shiluach, of sending away the mother, and he comes down, is bitten by a snake, and dies. And in this he even has a very deeper and profounder problem, and that is because this is one of the mitzvot where it actually notes explicitly the reward. And the reward is, if you do this, leman yitav lecha v'arachta yamim, it'll be good for you and you'll have long days. Here you have an empirical fact that goes against, that flies in the face of what the Torah says. It's empiricism. Elisha ben Avuya is only basing himself on scientific empiricism. The Torah says this. This guy did exactly what the Torah says. The Torah says this is what you'll get. And this guy dies. The other guy goes along his merry way. Actually, another variant that even makes it stronger. They combine the two mitzvot. Kabed et avicha ve et imecha. Honor your parents, which also guarantees a long life. And it combines the two. And there it's the father tells the guy, go up to the top and get me those eggs. So he's Mekayim. He's performing both mitzvot, and he falls off the tree and dies. Both mitzvot that guarantee long life. This is where Acher went wrong. This is where Acher went wrong. Zot Torah v'zot Schara. He says, is this Torah and is this its reward? Could this possibly be? This can't be. So, what is Elisha ben Avuya worried about? He's obviously worried about providence. He doesn't see providence. Remember the time that he's living in. He doesn't see the hand of God working in history. He sees not only just people dying. He doesn't live in Canada while the Holocaust is going on. His colleagues are dying around him. And not only his colleagues, but I would say his closest colleague. And now we'll talk about him, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, remember, we all know Rabbi Akiva. He doesn't decide to accompany or keep the company of any schlepper, right? He decides in this next Gemara to take a walk, also a famous Gemara, take a walk in the garden, in a pardes. This is 3D. This is also a very famous Gemara, where Rabbi Akiva, Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, and Elisha ben Avuya decide to take this journey, taken by most people to be some kind of mystical journey, pardes. The garden is a euphemism for entering the very limits of human knowledge about the divine, about the internal workings of the upper world. In fact, both Tosfot and Rashi see this as a trip. Tosfot sees this as they use the name of God to magically invoke a mind voyage. Rashi actually sees an actual voyage. But whatever the case is, this would seem to indicate entering into a domain where most people are shut out. It's a very interesting story, but I want to get to the end of it. And that is Acher's fate. One dies, one goes crazy. Rabbi Akiva goes in and enters and exits in peace. Acher comes out, and it says he cut the shoots, which is a euphemism for heresy. That is, he cut himself loose from the teachings that were planted in him or planted in the tradition. And what was it that he saw? And this is interesting. What was it that he saw? He goes up in this vision or in this journey, and he sees Metatron, a very prominent angel, kind of an archangel in Chazal, sitting and writing down the merits, recording the merits of Israel. And he slaps his head and he says, I learned in my tradition that on high, and there are variants of this, but on high there's no sitting, no standing, no competition, no back, no tiredness. Is it possible, Shema Chas V'Shalom Shtei Rishuyot, is it possible that there are two powers in heaven? Because as far as I know, angels don't do this. Angels don't sit. Angels don't have joints. Whatever the case may be, whatever anthropomorphic way you want to conceive this, he sees that this is not some kind of angel. Therefore, it must be, or possibly, another power that competes with God. So, taking this Gemara, and it's quite perplexing what exactly is going on here. But I would say that given this Gemara and given the other sources that we have about what Elisha ben Abuya's problem is, that problem finds its way in our story. Because what is Elisha ben Abuya considering? He's considering the possibility that there are two powers. What is the most common problem that would make one think that there are two powers? And it is the problem of evil in the world. That is stark and prominent and most evident evil. The response to that in the world was a theology where there are, in fact, two powers. Some refer to it as Gnostic dualism, although that's quite a history on its own. But the two powers is a solution, maybe not a very good solution for all of us, but a solution to the problem of how can a good, just God do these things or allow these things to happen. Well, he does because there is a competing power that has its own jurisdiction. You know that in Tanakh, the Tanakh actually goes against this and kind of militates against this. In the prayers, we know it as Yotzer Or Uvore Choshech. Although the original is Yotzer Or Uvore Ra. God is one who creates both light and evil. So the source of evil for monotheism is rooted in the one God. However, I would say that this is the problem. Elisha ben Avuya is informed by, in this journey as well, and he possibly maybe is looking for the answers to this problem. And the answer that he comes to is that there is no other solution to this problem, to what I'm seeing around me, to the hopelessness, the death, the slavery, the misery, the crucifixions. There is no other solution except that this God is not responsible for it, but there is another power. So this actually story, I think, goes hand in hand with the rest of the sources that talk about what Elisha ben Avuya's problem is. Now, what is fascinating about the story in the Gemara is that the story goes on, the Gemara goes on at great length afterwards about a relationship between Elisha ben Avuya and his cherished student, Rav Meir. And there's all sorts of give and take with Rav Meir. Rav Meir trying to protect his Rebbe, trying to bring him back into the fold. The students in the Beit HaMidrash telling him, by the way, there is a Gemara like this. By the way, your Rebbe is outside. There is a Gemara like that, where he's steeped in learning. He doesn't know what's going on outside. Obviously, the rest of the Talmidim want to hear what's going on in this guy's mind. After all, this was one of the primary movers of the academy. This is a friend of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva. So we want to know what's going on with him. So This is what happens. But before I get to what happens with that, let me just contrast Rabbi Akiva. So in the story, it seems clear that the foils, the two that are to be contrasted, are Rabbi Akiva and Elisha ben Avuya. Rabbi Akiva's approach is much, much different. Rabbi Akiva enters in peace, exits in peace. But let's see, as we did with Elisha ben Avuya, some of the other sources about Rabbi Akiva. And these, I'm sure, most of you, if not all of you, are familiar with. The very, very famous one, which is a popular one for Tisha B'Av. At the end of Makot, this is 4a, he's traveling with his students to the top of Har HaTzofim, which literally means the viewpoint, the point where you can scout out everything. And they see, once they reach the Har HaBayit, the place where the Beit HaMikdash once stood, they see a fox coming out of the, not just the Har HaBayit, not just the temple area, but the very inner sanctum, the Holy of Holies. His students begin to cry, and he begins to laugh, to smile. The students say to him, are baffled, how can you do that? Why are you laughing? And he says to them, why are you crying? And then he proceeds to darshan. And he says that, basically, I live the Tanakh. That is, when I see the world, I actually don't see the world. This is the way I see Rabbi Akiva. I see psukim, and through the psukim, I wear like these glasses with psukim. I mean, Rabbi Akiva is just an incredible figure. And so I read psukim that talk about the destruction and the desolation, and then I read psukim about the rebirth and the rebuilding and the reestablishment. Until I saw this fox, I didn't know whether the nevuah about desolation was true. Now that I see the nevuah about desolation, I'm happy, because I know that since that nevuah is true, the next nevuah, which is contingent on this one, of the rebirth, of the reestablishment of the state, is also true. Quite an incredible approach. At the end of that, the students say, Nichamtanu, you have comforted us. This is Rabbi Akiva. One more story of Rabbi Akiva, which is his death. And I picked the version that appears in the Yerushalmi, the death where they take him out and inflict unimaginable pain, the story we all know, virtually flaying him alive. But the story in Yerushalmi is interesting. And this is 4b. Tunus Rufus, the tyrant, the Roman tyrant, is standing over, supervising the torture, and like in the story you all know, Kriyat Shema, the time for saying Kriyat Shema, comes around, and Rabbi Akiva is happy. And Rufus turns to him, the tyrant Rufus, and says, old man, you are either a sorcerer. It's interesting what he says to him. You are either a sorcerer, or you are indifferent to suffering. Or you just have some kind of threshold of indifference that makes you impervious to pain. And Rabbi Akiva tells him, you idiot. Not in those words, but I'll bring it up to date. And then he relates what we all know. The time comes for me to dedicate my entire soul. I have this opportunity, and I should give up that opportunity. I surrender that opportunity. But what's interesting here is the viewpoints, the perceptions of Rufus and the perception of Rabbi Akiva. That is, Rufus is there as the empiricist. Right? Rufus is there, and what he sees is a physical body being skinned alive. And we know, you don't have to conduct many scientific experiments to know that that will cause unimaginable, inconceivable pain. And you don't have to conduct too many experiments to know what the reaction would be of someone who is subject to that torture. One reaction you can rule out, which is laughing or smiling. So Rufus can only see Rabbi Akiva's reaction, not for what it is, but for something that he can compute. And that is, you must be some kind of a sorcerer, which is interesting. Because as a sorcerer, you have powers somehow to change nature. Or even as a sorcerer, and this is, I think, is why the Torah is so down on sorcery and magic, is that in the pagan world, what sorcery and witchcraft and magic meant, and what's so heinous about it for Jewish theology, is that I can do certain things, I can perform certain rituals, and in that way, I control God. That is, if I do these things, God must listen to what I have to say. God must listen to what I would have him do. That's what's heinous about sorcery and magic. So he thinks that this is what Rabbi Akiva is doing. Rabbi Akiva is doing this. No. It has nothing to do with me changing nature or having some power over God that enables me to think I'm having a schwitz here, right, rather than undergoing this torture. I simply see nature in another way. I see nature, as I did before, through the psukim, the verses, God's words, if you will, informs nature, not the other way around. I don't go to nature and then, like a Shabbos drasha, I try to fit it into the psukim. That's not what he does. And here also, when I see nature again, when I see the morning sunlight, what it means to me is a time that I must remember my God. I see nature and the cycle of the sun, the revolution of the planets, all indicate something about my relationship to God. So Rabbi Akiva is somebody who has a very, very different take on life than Elisha ben Avuya. Now let's go back to Elisha ben Avuya and his travels with his student Rav Meir after he goes off the beaten track. One of those stories is, as I told you before, it begins with him studying in the Beit HaMidrash. Some have it on Shabbat, some have it on Shabbat that happens to land on Yom Kippur, just so you get the point. On Shabbat, that ends up to be on Yom Kippur, Elisha ben Avuya is riding on a horse. Also a no-no, I guess. Driving a car. While he's passing the Beit HaMidrash, the students tell Rav Meir, you're the only guy who can talk to this guy. You still have a relationship with this guy. Go and see what he's all about. And they travel and they have discussions. Lots of discussions, but what I wanted to get to was the following. This is fascinating. And by the way, the Gemaras, I think the point of the Gemaras are much more about relationship and how a student must conduct himself with his Rebbe, no matter what the Rebbe has done, with someone who has taught him something, who has helped him mature, than a story about a heretic who has to be burned at the stake. That's not what we really care about. So the story goes that he asks him, what have you been learning in the Beis Medrash? Come on, tell me, big shot. What do you learn in the Beis Medrash today? And he says, oh, well, interestingly enough, a pasuk from Iyov, another man that has a lot to do with Tisha B'Av. And it says, Vashem Beirach et Achrit Iyov Mereshito, at the end of the book, when everything is resolved, so to speak, God blesses Iyov with much more than he had at the start. So he asks him, and there is a saying in Kohelet, that Tov Achrit Davar Mereshito. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. So he asks Rav Meir, oh, you were studying that pasuk. So what's your pshat? So he says, oh, well, Iyov, it's simple. He had, I forget the numbers, 3,000, 7,000 oxen and sheep, and now he has 14,000. So he has double what he had in the beginning. In the beginning he had 7,000, now he has 14,000. And tov achrit davar mereshito, the end of the thing is better than the beginning, means all kinds of things. It means, you know, somebody who has children when he's born, loses them, and then regains, has other children when he's older. His end is better than his beginning. He has riches in the beginning, he loses them, and then he regains them when he's older. His end is better than the beginning. He learns Torah in his youth and forgets it. And in his older age, he recaptures it. That's what the pasuk means. That's what it means to be better at the end than the beginning. So Elisha ben Avuya turns to him, and this is in your source 5. Vai demovdin velo mishachin. Woe is to us for those who are lost and can never be retrieved. And who is he referring to? Rabbi Akiva. Akiva Rabka lo have darshkein. Akiva, your Rebbe, would not have darshened, would not have explicated the verses this way. Ela tov achrit davar mereshito bizman shehu tov mereshito. The end of a thing is good only if it comes from a good beginning. That's the way Rabbi Akiva, your Rebbe, would have looked at this pasuk. He wouldn't have looked at it in terms of empiricism. I don't travel with Rabbi Akiva anymore. And the reason I don't travel with Rabbi Akiva anymore, vai di avdin velo mishachin, woe are those who are lost and can no longer be found, which means Rabbi Akiva has been murdered. Which means Elisha ben Avuya has been, maybe not eyewitness, but witness in some sense to the flaying alive of his friend, his colleague, his Rebbe. And he says to Rav Meir, you don't appreciate where you come from. You don't appreciate your other Rebbe. You're maybe, I'll be a little fancy, maybe you've been too influenced by me. And you judge everything by an empirical outlook. He has 3,000 ox and now he has 6,000 ox. He has something when he's younger. He has more money when he's older. No. There is something that transcends this. The adage refers to something transcendent about the human being. That his life is informed by goodness if somehow he acts in a certain way. And therefore that action, that morality, whatever it is, where his life originates in, the source of his life, informs his life throughout, no matter what the reality is that surrounds him. Vai v'avdim lo mishachin. He's traveling with Rav Meir. He's been ousted from the academy. And he's lamenting the perspective of Rabbi Akiva. Maybe he's saying, you know what, Rav Meir, you haven't earned my position yet. You've only earned where I am sitting on this horse on Yom Kippur. When you've worked through Rabbi Akiva's teachings. You work through Rabbi Akiva's teachings. Go back to the Beis Midrash, work through his teachings, because all these teachings, he says, he reminds him, your Rebbe, Rabbi Akiva, would not have learned this way. Is a subtle, not so subtle hint to go back, work through the teachings. And once you've worked through them honestly and earnestly and sincerely, come back and we'll talk. By the way, the story ends quite marvelously, is that he says, Elisha ben Avuya says to Rav Meir, you can't go any further. He says, what do you mean I can't go any further? He's following behind. And he says, Ad Kan, we've reached the Tchum Shabbat. We've reached the limits of how far you can walk on Shabbat, because you can't walk past a certain distance. And Elisha ben Avuya goes, Rav Meir goes, how did you know? And he says, while we were talking, I was counting the hoofbeats of the horse, and I kept count of the distance we went. Now that's a very interesting Gemara. Probably from a kind of literary point of view, it means your place is still within the tchum. Your place are still within the boundaries of halacha, the boundaries of the Beit Midrash. My place, don't worry about it. I can go past this tchum because I'm already past it. I don't live within this tchum. I don't live within this domain. But you, I don't want you to cross this path until you've earned it. Again, not every schlepper is a heretic. You have to work through everything like I did. And if you come to my conclusions, so be it. But work through it. So, Elisha ben Avuya pays tribute to Rabbi Akiva. His life, in fact, itself is a tribute to Rabbi Akiva. In fact, maybe Rabbi Akiva is the one, when he sees that those phenomena of people going up and not chewing the mother away and going off in their merry way and then chewing off the mother according to the mitzvah and then dying. Rabbi Akiva is the one in some versions. Another is his grandson says, oh, Elisha ben Avuya did not know the teaching, Rabbi Akiva's new teaching, or maybe an old teaching, probably a new one. Rabbi Akiva interprets that verse, when you honor your parents or when you shoo away the mother bird, it will be good for you and you will have lengthy days, means it will be good for you in the world that is all good, and you'll have lengthy days in the world that is unending, that is lengthy, that is infinite. So Rabbi Akiva brings another viewpoint, another theology that Elisha ben Avuya was not willing to accept. It doesn't sound like such a difficult thing to read into the verse. But Rabbi Akiva says, true to his nature, there is another reality that I live in, as we saw with Rufus, as we saw with the fox going out of the Beit HaMikdash. I recognize another reality. Empiricism isn't everything. I recognize another world. I recognize another plane of existence, a world that is all good, a world that is unending. So there you have it. There you have the stark contrast between the two companions who took their walk in the garden. I think that what happens, the resolution of this Gemara, is Rav Meir. We have a new product in Rav Meir. Rav Meir, after all, is the Talmud of both Elisha ben Avuya and Rabbi Akiva. What does Rav Meir do? And I don't have time to go through all the Gemara, all the sources, but I'm going to focus on the resolution. Rav Meir constantly tries to salvage his teacher, constantly tries to save him, constantly prods him to do tshuva. But at the end, he says the following, or this is what happens. Elisha ben Avuya dies, possibly in tshuva, possibly not in tshuva. And this is source 7. And the grave, smoke starts to rise from the grave. The grave is smoldering, which means, and again, the students remind Rav Meir, we don't have anything to do with this guy, but by the way, your Rebbe's in trouble. Your Rebbe's in trouble. In the other world, things aren't going so well with him. And listen to what he does. This is the new product of both Rabbi Akiva and Elisha ben Avuya. This is source 7. He goes out, paras talito aleha, he spreads his cloak on the grave, and then he mouths psukim from Megillat Ruth. And aims them, I'll let you figure out who he's aiming them at. Lini halayla, sleep here tonight. This is from Ruth. The Gemara interprets. Ba'olam hazeh, in this world. Shekulo layla, that is all darkness, that is all night. Vahaya baboker, im yigalech, tov yigal. And this is again Ruth. And in the morning, if you will be redeemed, good, he will redeem you. Vaya baboker, then the Gemara interprets, ba'olam shekulo tov. Ba'olam shekulo tov. Where did he get this from? Not hard to figure out. In the morning, in the world, not olam hazeh, but in the world that is all good. Im yigalech tov, if tov redeems you, and Chazal read in Megillat Ruth, you know that famous scene where she's on the threshing floor and she's lying at his feet, and he says, well, wait to see, you have a closer relative, and Chazal say his name is Tov. If he redeems you, fine. If he doesn't, I will. The Gemara says, Tov is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Tov is God. Remember, Tov in Ruth is not actually a good guy. Tov in Ruth doesn't actually end up doing what he's supposed to do. He doesn't redeem Ruth. Rav Meir is standing there saying to God, I command you to stop this, to put out the flames, and if you don't, I will. Now that, I say, is a product of both Rav Meir and Elisha ben Avuya. Elisha ben Avuya has taught him to challenge. Rabbi Kiva has taught him to accept another plane of reality. Liyom Shekula Tov. And so it is that the ultimate resolution of this Gemara is in source 6. That is, at the very end of all these stories about Elisha ben Avuya, a cycle of stories between Rav Meir and Elisha ben Avuya, somebody meets Eliyahu. Hey, Eliyahu, how are you doing? You have your hand on the pulse of God. What's God doing now? And he says, God is mouthing all the teachings of all of Chazal except for Rabbi Meir. Why not Rabbi Meir? Because Rabbi Meir learned at the feet of a heretic. Rabbi Meir's teachings comes from a heretic. There's a response to God that, you know, you can eat the fruit and throw away the peel. And God surrenders to that response and then says, now God does quote Rabbi Meir's teaching. What is the teaching that he quotes? Bizman she'adam mitzta'er shechina ma lashon omeret. This is actually a Mishnah where Rabbi Meir actually says the following. When a man suffers, and this is not just any man, but a man who has been convicted of cursing God, who has been punished by death, who capital punishment has been meted out to him by a court of law. At the time that he's hanging, what does the Shechina say? Kalani Meroshi, Kalani Mizori. I am heavy of head, I am heavy of arms. An expression to mean that I am suffering along with this man. Im kacha kadosh baruch hu mitzta'er al daman shel rishayim. If God suffers for the blood of the wicked, kal v'chomer al daman shel tzadikim shenishbach. All the more so for the blood of righteous people whose blood has been spilled. So that the teaching that God has been taught to utter in the name of Rav Meir is one about suffering. One about that this may not answer anything, but this is not a theodicy. This is not an attempt. None of these are an attempt to justify God. Theodicy is a post-rabbinic kind of philosophical enterprise which tries to find a rationale of how God can live with injustice. This is not about that. This is about experiential. The experiential. Rabbi Akiva experiences this. There are problems philosophically, but Rabbi Akiva experiences this. And so Rav Meir brings this new notion in about suffering and that God suffers himself. But we cannot leave our Rebbe. And I will challenge suffering when I see it. I won't simply surrender to it because I'll say, Azoi Geisach, Siz Bashert. No. I won't stand for that because obviously the grave of Elisha ben Avuya smoldering is Bashert. Who else can be doing it but God? I won't accept it and I challenge you, God. And if you don't do it, I will. God wants us to rise up against suffering, not to accept it. And so let me come back to my original questions. I'm sure you thought that I wasn't going to answer my original questions. And that is the following. I would read the Mishnah this way. My original question was, why memorialize Elisha ben Avuya's name? And why this kind of uncomplimentary view about growing old? Let me twist it around. Give me a little license. And I would say the following after what I've said. That Elisha ben Avuya, just like we know he memorializes Rabbi Akiva, we know he wants you to know about Rabbi Akiva, we know he wants you to know about his teachings, so he has done that in this Mishnah. What he has done is paid tribute to his colleague and his friend for something that he could not do. And what is that? And that is to read this Mishnah in a completely different way. This is a teaching that Elisha ben Avuya learns from Rabbi Akiva. If you look at source 8, Tosfot Yom Tov kind of, I think, comes close to it, but still reads it in an uncomplimentary way. Niyar Machuk, how does he explain a rubbed out paper? Shekvar nechku bedato cheshbonot rabim me'inyanei ha'olam. Because etched in his mind, in an older person's mind, are many, many matters, worldly matters. After all, the older person has experienced many, many more things, has confronted many things, has confronted many challenges. He's experienced in worldly things. Ukishirtzel eskor divrei Torah, when he wants to remember divrei Torah, when he wants to remember theoretical things, intellectual matters, yitzarech lemachkam lootam hamachshavot, he needs to kind of rub out, make place for thinking, and needs to rub out some of the old stuff, some of the clutter he has in his head, and make room for this new stuff. And that's why he says, instead of the contrast, that he says a young person learns on a new, brand new paper, you would think that an old person learns on an old paper. No, it's on a rubbed out paper. That's the meaning why the Mishnah chose rubbed out. Because the person has to make room. So here's what I would say. This is a teaching that Elisha ben Avuya has learned from his friend Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, we know, actually started to learn, everybody knows the story, when he was older. 40, according to Avot Rabbi Natan. But what he was able to do was able to see the psukim, able to see those psukim that guarantee you reward for doing certain things, and was able to maybe rub out some of his old teachings and maybe impose a new teaching. Maybe give you something else. Maybe look at the psukim a different way. Maybe, Elisha ben Avuya, you're stuck with the pasuk. Black and white. That's the way it is. After all, Elisha ben Avuya is the empiricist. Rabbi Akiva is able, and this is Elisha ben Avuya's tribute to him, you are able to, and this turns the Mishnah around to the virtues of learning when you're old. Because a young person thinks everything he's got is right, it's it, you know, I don't understand why you don't agree with me, I've got all the answers, everything is clear. When you grow older, maybe things start to get not so clear. Maybe you have to develop new answers. Maybe you have to kind of supplement old answers with new. Maybe you have to renovate a little bit. There's too much clutter, and you have to build on top of it. That's Niyar Machuk. That's Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was able to do that. I wasn't. So, at the end of this, I wanted to mention just one final quote, which I have at the bottom of your page. And that is from, I think, one of those who should be made part of the ritual on Tisha B'Av. In addition to Eicha, in addition to something that was written, something very profound, something that was written thousands, we have those who are chroniclers of the greatest catastrophe that the Jews have ever lived through, including the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. 6 million people is far, far greater tragedy than the Beit HaMikdash. A building can be rebuilt. Stones can be put up again. So there are people who are chroniclers of this misery, who live through it. One of them, I think the greatest of them, is Primo Levi. And last year I mentioned the Warsaw Ghetto Rebbe. This year I'd like to mention Primo Levi. The two of them should be made mandatory reading on every Tisha B'Av. Both have a lot in common and a lot that separates them. Both are Jews. However, one, the Warsaw Ghetto Rebbe, is steeped in the learning, thousands of years of Jewish learning, a Hasidic Rebbe, Primo Levi, an Italian assimilated Jew, the Warsaw Ghetto Rebbe, a master of rabbinic lore and learning, Primo Levi, a PhD in chemistry. However, what they do share is chronicling and having lived through and faced and thought about in serious ways this great tragedy. And this is Primo Levi. And I thought Primo Levi captured actually both Elisha ben Avuya and both Rabbi Akiva in this. And this is what he says about the Rabbi Akivas. Not only during the crucial moments of the selection for the gas chamber or the aerial bombings, but also in the grind of everyday life, the believers lived better. They all held in common the saving force of their faith. They had a key and a point of leverage. Now listen to this and remember Rabbi Akiva. And I don't think Primo Levi was familiar with the Gemaras. A millennial tomorrow, Liyom Shekulo Aruch, a millennial tomorrow, so that there might be a sense to sacrificing themselves, a place in heaven or on earth where justice and compassion had won or would win in a perhaps remote but certain future, Liyom Shekulo Tov. Sorrow in them or around them was decipherable and therefore did not overflow into despair. Elisha ben Avuya despair, Rabbi Akiva would not let the sorrow overflow into despair. However, and not to dismiss Primo Levi's approach, because this is not Primo Levi's approach, and not to dismiss Elisha ben Avuya's approach, but only to dismiss it if you stand where he stands, and if you've gone through what he's gone through. And that's the following, and listen to what he has to say. He says, I was tempted to take the same approach. I entered the lager a non-believer, and as a non-believer, I was liberated and have lived to this day. But not just because I wanted to have a good time, I like to eat treif. That's not what it's about. Listen to this. I don't think actually you can find a more religious man. Actually, the experience of the lager with its frightful iniquity confirmed in me my non-belief, Elisha ben Avuya. It has prevented me and still prevents me from conceiving of any form of providence or transcendent justice, Elisha ben Avuya versus Rabbi Akiva. Naked and compressed among my naked companions, with my personal index card in hand, I was waiting to file past the commission, the one which, with one glance, would decide whether I should go immediately into the gas chamber or was instead strong enough to go on working. Now listen to this. For one instance, I felt the need to ask for help. I felt the need to daven. For one instance. Then, despite my anguish, equanimity prevailed. One does not change the rules of the game at the end of the match, nor when you are losing. A prayer under these conditions, is he religious? Is he not religious? A prayer under these conditions would have been not only absurd, what rights could I claim? From whom? But blasphemous. Is he religious? Obscene. Laden with the greatest impiety. Is he religious? Of which a non-believer is capable. I rejected the temptation. I knew that otherwise, were I to survive, I would have to be ashamed of it. Shame. Is he religious? He adopted the tradition of Elisha ben Avuya, and he lived it to the end. Thank you.